Marquise Daisey, ESPN Films, Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. Welcome to Combos Court. How are things?
Everything's great, man. Just excited for the spring, excited for some more sunlight, and some good weather coming this way, in a good old northeast in New Jersey. So I'm excited, man. Everything's good.
Okay, I'm not too far from you in New York. You grew up in New York, Brooklyn.
I grew up in Brooklyn. Yeah.
Filmmaking and storytelling. So closely related, right? And often the storytelling is about humans. So growing up in Brooklyn, what did you learn about storytelling and human nature?
It's a great question. I think about it all the time, right? Like I think for me growing up in Brooklyn, I was able to sort of be subjected to a million different lifestyles, right? Like I grew up in Bed-Stuy. And I grew up in a Bed-Stuy where I like to say it was the Bed-Stuy, right? Before the sort of development of it in its current terms. But I grew up in a situation where sports essentially was everything, right? Like that was the outlet for kids in the summertime. And really sports were really like the way out for a lot of kids. So in terms of like storytelling, like I was able to just kind of like pay attention to sort of what people around me were doing. I was fascinated by the single moms who were taking their kids to school every day, making ends meet, by the neighborhood heroes who were sports stars. And celebrities within their own right within community, and just life in general, right? Just kind of like being in that bubble known as Brooklyn, and getting to Manhattan was just kind of like this privilege. You never really left the borough, and I think within that, I started to develop this gene for storytelling. It was like figuring out what was going on in my own world, but also curious as to what was going on outside of it. And I think like that's kind of where the storytelling sort of gene started from. It's sort of just being in this bubble when I was much younger. I think that's where it all sort of comes from.
Paying attention to people is so important in that regard. Do you think it's harder? We're living in a digital era for people to, everybody's on their phone all the time. Is it harder for people to pay attention to their surroundings, pay attention to those people? Because you seem to have so much curiosity growing up in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's you have more exposure to people's lives now in social media, but I don't think it's necessarily the true gauge of like what's going on with people, right? Like I think for
True.
me growing up, like I used to take a lot of symbols from being on the New York City subways, right? And I used to look at like old people, older people, and again, like the single moms and look at like, just different type of people. And I was just always curious to know what's going on in their world, what was it about their expression? Like, sometimes you could just see people exhausted from work. People have stress on their faces and some people are happy, right? And I was just always curious to know, like, what was going on in their households, and what was going on in their worlds that was able to make everybody so different. And I just always was curious like that. And I know probably fast forwarding it a little bit, but I ended up being one of those kids who left New York City as part of like the Boys Club of New York scholarship program to go to prep school. And that just opened up a totally different world for me, which was like the antithesis of like what Brooklyn looked like in terms of like people didn't look like me. So, it's just, I think it's all sort of rounded into the same sort of path in a funny way.
Let's get into one of your films, The Dominican Dream.
Yeah.
High school basketball was so different back then, and this movie was about Felipe Lopez. How have things changed from your perspective just working on that movie? Obviously, you lived it as well. You played high school basketball yourself and seeing what it is now.
I mean, it's funny, right? Because that film specifically was directed by John Hawke, and I was a producer on it for the network for ESPN. But I worked really closely with John Hawke, and long story short, I've known John Hawke for a really long time. And I think we were just fans of New York City basketball in general, right? Like, so I grew up, we talked about it, but I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. My older brother, Darrell, used to play for Boys and Girls High School back in the days. That's where Kerr Washington went and all of the greats, right? Out of Brooklyn. And
And it used to be called Boys,
it
right?
used to be called Boys High. But when my brother was there, it was Boys and Girls High. And that was our zone school in Brooklyn, right? And for me, like I used to go with my brother to basketball practice every morning. Just obsessed with being around the team and obsessed with like New York City basketball and playground basketball. And things of that sort. It was really playground basketball before we knew the term playground basketball in a lot of different ways. And then, you know, when I started to get serious about basketball, at some point you just started to hear about this phenom called Felipe Lopez. And it was like, it was a phenomenon to us because he wasn't native to New York City. Now he became loved in New York City because I think, you know, he ultimately became a hero of Washington Heights, which is like largely. But I believe you could correct me. You would know better than I do. But I believe he was like the first high school kid on Slam Magazine or Sports Illustrated or one of those. But he went to Rice High School.
I mean, he was literally getting compared to Michael Jordan.
Oh yeah, I mean, he was grown man playing against boys in a sense.
Right, right.
I just remember like his game was so polished. It was like this guy who could barely speak English, and he was just so good. So when that opportunity came around, when John Hawk was directing that film and I jumped on the board as a producer, I had a like intrinsic knowledge of it already. Like I remembered that time and we would just kind of like, you know, go back and forth with ideas on like, you know, how to make it better. But also just like, I just would share my memories of like what that time was like. It was crazy. Like uptown in the Bronx and Gaucho's Gym and Felipe was just, I mean, he was doing his thing back then. And that was, you know, Stephon Marbury to this day is still my favorite basketball player ever, of anybody ever. But he was right before Steph, like right before Steph, I believe. And Felipe was a guy, right? He was just something else. And it's appropriately titled The Dominican Dream because he was like the first of its kind for sure.
Yeah, is there still another movie to be made about Steph? I kind of feel like he got game is like lightly influenced by like Steph Curry. I mean, Stephon Marbury a little bit. And obviously there's been a bunch of documentaries. Is there still a movie to be made on him?
100%. Like I think about that almost every day. I kid you not. Okay. And that's with all respect to everyone else who's done those films. Right. You know, I know Cootie and Chike, fabulous filmmakers who did a film on Felipe, on Stephon Marbury as well. I think there's a story to be told from my vantage point in terms of like a kid growing up in Brooklyn, watching that whole phenomenon. And, you know, I mean, Steph was it. He was it. I mean, he was the guy who would jump 3 feet off of the ground and shoot his jump 100%. Shots. He was quick. Yeah. He was fast. He had that part up the middle of his head. He was from Brooklyn.
Yeah. And people say New York City guards can't shoot. He could even shoot it with range. He had everything.
He could do it all. He could do it all. Like he dispelled a lot of those myths. Like he could actually shoot, right? Like we were all quick. We were all quick. We could all hit the ball, but like he was a little different. Like he could shoot the ball, and he was always playing in Madison Square Garden. So if you grew up here, right, this is before the Brooklyn Nets were a thing. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to watch pro basketball in New York City, you had to go to Madison Square Garden, 34th Street.
Right.
And I remember those PSLL championships where Lincoln would go, and the whole borough would go against like Robeson High School. Like it was fun.
Yeah.
There is a story to be told on Steph, I believe, especially in the maturation of his life and what's come full circle. But I think the real story is right in Coney Island, Conrad McRae, you know, the Marbury brothers, the Thomas family, the projects, right? That's the story to me. And I think there is a story to be told when he's ready to tell it.
Different times. Speaking of different times, the pandemic, very interesting times, almost synonymous with The Last Dance at this point, right? People think about The Last Dance when they think about the pandemic. You were at ESPN Films. You're still at ESPN Films during the pandemic. What were those times like for you, and what do you remember about them?
I mean, those were scary times. Those were also exciting times in a sense, in terms of like the work that we do, right? Like, I mean, you got to remember, right? Like we were driving to the gas station with blue rubber gloves on. Everyone thought the world was ending. And in a sense, it was ending in that moment, right? But also people were idle, people were home. And I think as a network and also as a brand, the 30 for 30 brand, we felt like we had this film in the workings, The Last Dance on Jordan, right? And that season. And there was no better director than Jason Hare, who also did the Fab Five. He and I did Bernie and Ernie together.
And you have a close relationship
with Jason, very close right? relationship.
Yeah,
with
yeah. Jason. Yeah. Right.
And we did, so he was directing that film during the pandemic. But I remember, like, it was sort of staggered. I remember when, like, episodes 1 and 2 were airing, you know, I might be off by an episode or two, but, like, when a few of the episodes were airing, he was still editing the back end of it. So it's like when the world would see that first episode 1 and everyone was super, super excited about this product and it was nostalgia. Michael Jordan, right? It was
right,
fun.
Right.
With that crown, Jason had all of this pressure to get the remaining episodes done. And then also us as a network, right? Like there's no one that you want to trust more than that guy to make films. But also it's like, once you gave episode 1, people were looking for episode 2 through. And Jason was just like a machine in the background making it happen. And we all had our hands on it, right? Like, I mean, from a creative standpoint, he created that film. That's his film. But from marketing, from placement, from the politics of putting together a film, all of that stuff was still happening in the background. So while people were scared and afraid and at home and not really like looking out their front doors, he was working and we were working, right? And it was just such a pleasure to kind of see that thing hit the air every time because we knew the work that was going into it. Like it was crazy. It was unbelievable.
So I learned from you and Indy that there was episodes not even made yet when the first 2 episodes were released.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say they weren't necessarily made, but they weren't complete for sure.
Okay.
It's like they did a lot of shooting and a lot of that was in a can, right? Like it's almost like a very talented writer. You have right. all of these ideas on all these notepads and you're still putting it together, but it's not complete.
Okay.
That's kind of like what was happening. And I believe like they even went out and did a couple more interviews while some of the episodes were on the air.
So they weren't edited, right?
No, they weren't completely edited. No.
Wow. Okay. Okay. No. Yeah. Yeah.
And if you know anything about television, it's like, it takes a while to edit, right?
Right. Right.
It takes a while. And
especially from home. During the pandemic, right?
Yeah, a lot of it was from home. I think they were at a post house as well.
Okay.
You got to remember, like, the Wi-Fi was down. Well, Wi-Fi wasn't down, but, like, we didn't have all of this, like, fancy stuff that we kind of have now.
Right.
Where things are much faster. We were sharing HD files over the, you know, over internet. Some people had dial-in. It was nuts. It was crazy. A lot of sleepless nights to make that thing happen. Yeah, and you know, I think that's one of the marvels of sports television or television in general. That's a story to be told about just kind of like how I think to date it's still the highest rated ESPN documentary ever.
Yeah,
and it wasn't even totally complete when it was on the air. Like it was insane.
Greatest sports
and
doc
the note process too, right?
Yeah,
that's lengthy as well. So yeah. Although you're editing in the background, you still have to like make sure all parties. You know, or that the editing parties are on board. So it was a task for sure.
Greatest sports doc ever?
Greatest sports is up there. It's up there. I mean, I got a couple very subjective, right? Last Dance in terms of nostalgia, absolutely the best one. In my opinion, entertainment factor for sure. My personal sort of, I have a couple favorites that are great. I love the OJ film. Everyone does. Mm-hmm. OJ Made in America. I love Benji by Kuti and Chike.
Great movie.
I just thought that was a Brooklyn story in itself, right? Like
it right,
was,
yeah.
Tragedy, right? I mean, there are a few that were just like really, really, really good, but those are some. I mean, Duke Lacrosse, Fantastic Lies, was another one that was really good. Rodman from For Better or Worse. There are a couple of them that were really good, but I think. Listen, Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan, right? There's only one of him. And star factor. Like,
yeah.
That thing is going to stand the test of time. And it's certainly, I would say that OJ and the Escobars are the 30 for 30s that people, or the ESPN films that people will remember for a really, really, really long time, for sure.
Staying on The Last Dance for one more moment, is the story of Michael Jordan a sad one?
A sad one. I wouldn't call it sad. I would say that like it's one that people are still curious about, right? You know, I think in a lot of ways it was a little too short. His career. But in a lot of ways, it was perfect, right? Like that little break that he had, I think gave people a bigger appreciation for him that year or two or whatever it was that he was off. In terms of like the tragic nature of it, I don't know. I wouldn't call it sad or tragic for sure, because like he's still a symbol, right? And he's still a beloved idol and icon. But I will say that like we didn't get, in my opinion, we didn't get every bit of Michael Jordan that that the public clamored for back then. And maybe that's a good thing, right? Like
yeah.
that's what a good tease or trailer is. You leave people wanting more.
Yeah.
I think that if Michael Jordan were living in the same world that LeBron is living in, perhaps he'd be remembered differently. Like there was a mystery about Michael Jordan. I think there's a reason why X many years later, people are still wearing his shoes. Like they're the same shoes over and over and over again. And it's because like there's a mystery about him. I don't think there's any other shoe that could repeatedly come out again and again and again and sell the way that does. Like it's never going to happen again. And there will be people who are more popular than Michael Jordan. We've seen it, right? Tiger Woods, perhaps LeBron James, but like there's a mystique about Jordan, man. It's that symbol, man. It's something about it.
Yeah, it feels like this story is going to continue with Pippen, Longley, and Horace going on a tour.
Yeah, I have like a group chat with a lot of my college friends, and that has been a topic. You know, Scottie Pippen's separate initiative. You know, everyone has their own story, right? You know, Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan. He's the guy. He's the guy who will be around a long time. So,
yeah.
But everybody has a story, right? So I'm curious to know what Scottie Pippen's story is for sure.
Yeah, it seemed like in The Last Dance that he wasn't. Jordan wasn't happy that he got the surgery at the time he got the surgery, and you know there was that thing, and that's not all of it, obviously, but that's what it seemed like. That was a focus of The Last Dance. It felt like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of it was just really from the vantage point of Michael Jordan's experience, right? And I think, you know, again, like this is all subjective, right? Like it's like people remember history differently.
100%.
I think everyone's spoken out honestly about like Scottie Pippen's role and like, you know, what happened with his career and things of that sort and their relationship. But I think The Last Dance was great for what it was in terms of like highlighting that area of it all. Is there more to be said? Perhaps. And I think that's what Scottie's doing right now, right? I think a lot of it was from Jordan's vantage point.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the evolution of sports stocks? How do you think things might change moving forward? You know, we have AI now. People's attention spans are shorter. Will there be shorter docs? Like, what do you think of it? And what are you putting into your own craft to stay with the zeitgeist or create a new zeitgeist?
Yeah, no, I think in terms of the craft of sports documentary filmmaking, I think we're going to see a lot more before we start seeing less of them, right? Like, I think people are enamored. I mean, sports stars outside of like our parents, sports stars are like our heroes. Whether or not they ask the athletes ask for it or not, they become our heroes. You know, I have a almost 7-year-old son who he's talking about Ronaldo and like what type of cars Ronaldo drives and like, you know, he's obsessed with Steph Curry and Travis Kelce and all of these guys. Like, so these become like their heroes. And I think it's going to be more and more ubiquitous. Like it'll continue to be like in front of us. I think these multi-part series that we're seeing have been a thing that's been very, very popular. I think there's a sort of shift, or there will be a shift, to go back to sort of one or two sort of documentaries within one subject at a time, rather than like, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 series documentaries. But I think that, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more sports documentaries moving forward than we expect, right? Because like people are just, again, like they're fascinated by the stories of these athletes.
They want more. They always want more, more information, more access. Yeah. Yeah.
And think about it too. Like we've never been this close to athletes. They've never been this like easy to touch, right? Like they're on social media, they're sharing who they are.
Yeah.
They're giving us a sense of like their character, how they grew up, where they're from, and just also like what's going on in their minds in between games and in season. And I think people just want more and more of that. And I think for that reason, like we just want the content. So it's an exciting time for the brand, but also for sports documentary storytelling in general.
Yeah, I've been watching 30s for 30s for so long, and to me, like 30 for 30s are like the Jadakiss of sports docs. Like you never heard a bad Jadaverse, right? Like I never seen a bad 30 for 30, and honestly, most of them are absolutely fantastic. How has the ESPN 30 for 30 series stayed so dominant for so long?
You know, it's I think staying true to the fan, right? Like I think that's the big thing. I think we always just try and like pride ourselves on doing what we call like the definitive work within a subject, right? So, you know, we want to be like the last documentary that you see on a subject, and I think if you stick to that principle, you know, you're going to continue to resonate with the fan. But I will say that like it's exciting that there are like so many other outlets out there, right? There are a lot of people and a lot of companies doing films, and it forces us to step our game up for sure. Because then like there becomes the question of demographic, right? What does the 25-year-old want to see? You know, do they want to see Mikey Williams and like how great he is on a court, and that type of thing? Or do they want to see, you know, the Sean Kemps of the world or whoever it is? And I think there's a balance, right? And I think like it's forcing all of us to like rethink what the public wants. But I think for 30 for 30, standing on a principle of like evergreen storytelling and being a definitive work has been a secret, you know, it's been a formula that's worked for us. But also like, you know, when you think about it, like the 60s, 70s and the 80s, like a lot of those stories have been told already, right? So now you're graduating 90s and the 2000s and it's like, there's a bunch of stories out there and they're up for grabs. And that's the exciting part. It's like, who's going to grab what story, how they're going to be told, what director is going to tell those stories, and how do you give those stories wings, like once people get their hands on them. So it's exciting. Yeah, but it's the competition makes everyone step up and want to tell that best story and also work with the best storytellers too.
Yeah. Marquise, what are you working on? Anything we should know about on your end?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch that we're working on this and some that haven't been announced. But one thing that like I'm really excited about is there's a film that's directed by this guy, Ismael El Amin. He's native to Ohio, but the subject is on Butch Reynolds, who is kind of like this forgotten Olympian sprinter from late 80s, 90s type. And he had a faulty drug test. Back then. And, you know, this is sort of the story of that and how, you know, way before we were thinking, you know, that's a film that's coming really soon.
June 9th, okay.
Which is going to be a lot of fun to watch. So I would say like, that's the big one that like, you know, I've been working on. But as a brand, you know, we're excited about a lot of things, that like we're doing, like, Brittany Griner as an original initiative, which is going to be also fabulous, and I think that one has been announced as well. So there's a lot coming up, man. Look, you got some good stories. Hit me up, man. Like we're always looking for great stuff.
I want to see a newer Pistol Pete doc.
Oh, Pistol Pete, the Godfather, man.
You think there's still a story to be told, or there's been enough already on him?
There's always a way to tell those stories again, but from a different vantage point, right?
Yeah.
We got to figure out a different lane into it. I'm not sure that there's been a documentary done on him at all, really.
Remember when ESPN used to do like the shorter ones? There wasn't 30 for 30 yet, right? But they would sit a whole people down for an interview. I mean, Pete had one of those, but I don't think he's had a longer one, you know?
Got you. Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious to know like whether or not the NBA Entertainment has done some stuff on him. I'm sure they have, because they have that good old archive over there, and they have that that vault of footage.
Speaking of archives, how many 30 for 30s has there been at this
over
point?
100. Like, I've lost track. I think we're 115 ish.
Wow.
But it started out as just 30 films commemorating the 30th, you know, the 30 years of ESPN. And God willing, and you know, the brand has been blessed, and like it's going right. Like, it's
definitely
kind of
going
in the space, so it's moving. And you know, we have some titles that haven't been announced yet that'll keep us busy for the foreseeable future. So hopefully that number keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. Because 30 for 30 has become synonymous with like storytelling in general. Forget sports films. It's become like a respected documentary,
definitely
journalistic form of storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, that's how we started the conversation. Human nature, storytelling. Mm-hmm. Now we're here full circle. Marquise, keep up the great work. You know, you're always welcome back on this show. Where can we find you? I don't know if you're the big social media guy. Where can we find you on social media?
You know, since I've become a dad, my social media is all my kids. So I'm just Marquise Daisy on Instagram, but I'm the same all across. It's like on Twitter. Sometimes I'll poke my head in on Twitter. I mostly read stuff on Twitter.
Okay.
Instagram, I just kind of share, you know, my kids walking and
So it used to be in the streets. You're watching people. Now you're watching people on Twitter. Maybe Twitter's the new streets.
Twitter is the streets, man. Like, it's crazy. Like, I'm seeing all of my best friends' kids as well with their milestones as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Graduations and people I haven't seen in 30 years as well.
Yeah.
It is the streets. It's the safer streets, per se.
It is.
Where you can watch from afar. But it's fun.
Right. Marquise, thanks for taking the time. You're always welcome back on the show, and talk soon.
Love it. Thank you.